I think it's easy to allow yourself to be discouraged. And sometimes it's a voice in your head that's discouraging you, and sometimes it's other people's indifference or lack of interest that discourages you. And I think first and foremost, you have to believe in what you're doing. And that's the biggest motivator, the biggest reason for doing it. And of course, you hit walls every once in a while where you start to doubt, and you just have to be persistent. You've chosen a path, whatever that path is, and sometimes there'll be obstacles and you have to find a way around them, over them, under them, you know, through them. But I think it's a level of dedication that you bring to something that you love doing.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive into the mind shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I'm your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we are honored to have a genuinely remarkable guest, Michael James, a pioneering quilt artist, esteemed author, and influential educator. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Michael's dedication to quilt making as a studio practice. His acclaimed work redefines the traditional boundaries of textile art, exploring the intricate dance between order and disorder through his masterful manipulation of patterns and colors. Michael's quilts have graced the halls of prestigious institutions worldwide, including the Museum of Arts and Design in New York and the Renwick Gallery at the Smithsonian. Behind his artistic achievements, Michael has shaped future generations through his roles in leadership at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, fostering a deep appreciation for textile arts. As we dive into this conversation, we look forward to unraveling the layers of Michael's illustrious career and gaining insights into the visionary behind the quilts. Michael, it's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Yolanda. It's great to be with you.
Well, I feel fortunate to be able to have called you a friend for numerous years now. Our paths have crossed with my connection with the University of Nebraska. And just thank you for all of your graciousness over the years.
Well, and congratulations to you on all your achievements over the years since you left UNL.
Oh, you're very kind.
The department remains very proud of you.
Oh, well, I'm very proud to be an alum of the department, so thank you. Oh, well, I mean, this is a special year for you. So we're celebrating your golden jubilee on your quilt making journey.
It was the end of last year where it dawned on me. It was like, I think in sometime in November last year, it just hit me. Gee, next year will be 50 years that I've been doing this as a sort of professional undertaking. And I had nothing really on the boards much in terms of my studio career this year. So I thought, well, I should mark this in some way. And so I launched into a reflective blog that is on my website, Michael James Studio Quilts at 50. And I've been posting at irregular intervals, reflections on that career. And at this point, I'm about to post something that relates to the late 1990s. So I'm very shortly going to get into writing about my experience in the university domain, which was a big shift for me. Because when I got involved in quilts in the early 1970s, I was an independent maker fresh out of graduate school. And I, by hook and by crook and happenstance, created a freelance career in the field of quilts, which of course is unusual for anybody, but especially unusual for a white male fine arts painter and printmaking trained person. It's been an interesting journey for sure.
Well, and your background is so diverse in fine arts. What made you choose to go down the pathway of quilt making as your medium?
There were a number of things, a number of reasons. First of all, in the early 1970s, there was a widespread focus on traditional American arts and crafts because we were leading up to the bicentennial celebration, which took place in 1976. And so there was a lot of writing about and reporting on various traditional art and craft practices, historical practices that go back to the founding of this country and so on, and before that. And so that attention got my attention. And I was especially wowed by the graphic designs in quilts, that many of which were so powerful visually that they were arresting. It was hard not to pay attention to them. And that coincided with my marrying my late wife, Judith, who was a sewer and had been since she was a child. And we met in art school. She was a graphic design and photography major. And once we started building a life together, she had all the accoutrements of sewing around. And I've always been a bit of an iconoclast or a maverick, and I don't follow prescribed modes of operation. So the fact that I was a man looking at something that historically women didn't faze me. In fact, I was hoping it would endear myself to her even more because I thought of myself as a feminist, and she certainly was. In any case, she encouraged me and I started dabbling in this partly as a relief from the stress of working on my Master of Fine Arts degree. And by the time I finished my degree, the interesting thing was I had been paying attention, of course, to what was happening in the art world broadly. And that was the moment when installation art was starting to become a form, and performance art was starting to get momentum. And I was not interested in that. And I was not seeing myself fitting into what I sensed at the time was the future of fine arts, at least at a certain level. And so within a few months of getting my graduate degree, I stopped painting altogether and was working exclusively in fabric. And that was by 1974, that's what I was doing. And the rest is history, as they say.
A great history, a really amazing history. Yeah, your work is known for intricate patterns and really exploring the balance between order and chaos, and your use of color is extraordinary. Can you discuss your approach to pattern design and how you approach it as a quilt maker first?
Good question. I loved my undergraduate and graduate education. And I loved the pedagogical systems that my professors and my instructors used in delivering this material that we as students had to learn. And that formation obviously fed into how I approached my own work once I was out on my own. And I've always had a big interest in the, I guess I have to use that word pedagogical again, that the pedagogical rationales for how and why certain systems of design developed and how they get applied. I have always been a big fan of the Bauhaus, for example. The Bauhaus is a German art school that whose practices and principles really laid the foundation for how art was taught in this country in the 20th century. Anyway, I built on that foundation. And while I was generally fairly thoughtful and intentional in approaching the design work I was doing, I also looked for opportunities to break rules or go out on a limb and take some risks and see what happened. And I think while I certainly didn't have a conventional career launch, in fact, I didn't even know really that I had a career until I had been doing it for 4 or 5 years. I was just piecing it all together. And literally and also metaphorically. And it was a long time, really. It was into the late 1980s before I realized that I had built a business, that I had a small business. I didn't see my practice that way. I was this maker who made things and did these things in isolation in my studio and then put them out in the world and hoped that people would respond to them. Once, I guess it was a level of maturity that I reached where I started to realize that this was in fact a business. I was able to broaden that, my practice to embrace also the management of this small, and it worked. And it took me through this whole 50 year plus period. I do think people, when you talk about the arts today, and I even saw this when I was at the university, when I was in the textiles department, especially with students who were pursuing degrees in textile design, many of those students would be minors in, say, the art department. So they'd be taking courses in that part of the university as well. They were always fearful about how they might make a living with this. But I've known a lot of artists through my career, and they all make a living. And they all do it in their own way, and they use different strategies and they pull together different means and mechanisms for earning the living that they need to earn. So it's highly doable. But I think for me, it got much better once I realized that this was a business that I had created. And while it was also an art practice, I had to always consider those two pieces together and make sure that they were in balance. And I was fortunate. It worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you were one of the pioneers in really creating an art business. And I love what you said about considering the practice and the business together and really recognizing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't underestimate the value of taking advantage of opportunities. And that was one thing that I learned early on. I was approached in the late 1970s by a publishing house that actually contacted me through an arts school where I was teaching one-off courses. This was in the Boston area. And they were looking for people to write craft books. And the head of the school came to me and said, this publishing house, it was Prentice Hall at the time, they're looking for authors to write books on crafts. And I'm wondering if you're teaching quilting here, would you like to do a book on quilts? And it was like the furthest thing from my mind. And I thought, oh gosh, do I really? No, this is not what I want to do. I want to make. This is what I'm doing. But I said I'd think about it. And I happened to go to a small conference in upstate New York, and I met a very well-known writer then and still, although Gene passed away a few years ago, Gene Ray Laurie, well-published author in the 1960s and 70s and 80s of books related to quilting and quilts, stitching, patchwork, all that stuff. And I got into a conversation with her, and I explained that this, I just recently had this proposal. And she said, well, she said, I suggest you do it. Because if you don't do it, they'll just ask somebody else. And she said, I've always looked at opportunities like this as doorways. So that's my opinion. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, I think maybe I should do it. She's right. And I'll always be grateful for her insight in helping me to realize that when opportunity comes knocking, take advantage of it. And so I've generally pretty much always said yes to opportunities, and which is how I landed at the University of Nebraska. You know, because after 25 years on my own, this amazing opportunity presented itself. They had just established the organization that came to become the current International Quilt Museum. It was originally the International Quilt Study Center and Museum. And it was for about its first, 23 years or so, embedded in the Department of Textiles, Merchandising, and Fashion Design. And I was asked initially to be a member of their International Advisory Board. This was back in 1997. And that brought me out to the Midwest, the East Coast, and for the first time, west of the Mississippi. And that actually is not true. I did come to Lincoln for the first time in 1977 for a quilt conference here. So that was my first excursion. But I was back in 1997 to be part of this organization. And it was at a moment when I was just beginning to think about what the next part of my life would be. I was approaching my 50th birthday. So I was at midlife stage. And that's a moment when a lot of people take stock of what they have done, where they've been, and where they feel they want to go. And my late wife and I were doing exactly that. And so I had actually started looking for an art school position, because I thought working, teaching full-time as opposed to teaching as an itinerant workshop leader all over the world, as interesting as that was, and as fabulous as the travel was and the people that I met and so on, I had reached the point where that kind of business travel was wearing thin. And I also was frustrated by the inability to see people develop over time. And I knew that students working in programs towards degrees, where they're going to be working with you for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, you get a better picture of their development and a better sense of the impact that you're having on that development. And anyway, I was searching, and the University of Nebraska learned that I was, and they happened to have a position that was actually a good fit. So they asked if I'd be interested in coming to Nebraska. And I went home and asked my wife, what do you think about Nebraska? And to her credit, she said, let's do it. And we did. And the interesting thing for her, she had been in retail, the retail fabric and home sewing business. She was a Bernina dealer, and she sold sort of high quality fashion fabrics. She did not have a quilt shop business. she had done retail for 20 years and she was also ready for a change. And so when I came in as a faculty member into the department, she came into the department as a student and got her Master of Arts degree in textile design, and then had a, until her death, had a successful career in independent textile art. Yeah.
She was extremely talented. I remember her work, and extremely talented.
Yeah. So all that fed into how, you know, how when opportunities presented themselves, I decided to do it. And I probably at this point have a bit less motivation and desire than I had when I was 50. But that's partly the fact of age and retirement and changing conditions. And while I still enjoy being in the studio, I'm not compulsive or obsessive about it. Doing a lot more writing these days, and I'm finding that is just as creative. It uses the same kind of elements of the invention and imagination and problem solving that is required to do visual work, only it uses different elements. It uses words, and I like that, and I get a lot of satisfaction from that as well.
Well, I'm so thankful that you're capturing your work and your process and writing about it, because many times artists and designers do not do that and they leave it up to other people to tell their story. So thank you for doing that.
Well, the truth is I've always been a reader, a big reader. Books and reading is food to me. It's just as essential as food and water. And I've always enjoyed reading artists' memoirs or journals or notebooks discussing their work. Now, I've seen many times people say dismissively, oh, don't trust a word an artist says about their work. And there may be some truth to that in some cases, possibly. But I find, and I've always pulled a lot of encouragement and a lot of real support from reading what other artists experienced and how they went about doing their work or managing their lives or dealing with all of the issues that pop up. In any case, I have to also say that at my age, and I just turned 75, I can see my mortality. You enter this, a writer named Doris Grumbach, whose journals I've read and enjoyed a lot. And she called one of them Coming Into the End Zone. Mm-hmm. And she wrote it when she was in her 70s. And that is where I'm at. And I don't have a problem with it. It's the natural course of things. But it seems like it's a moment where you can pull back from the hustle and bustle and the rat race and take stock. And I find it's quite fulfilling. I have to say that I didn't intend this at the outset when I started working on that blog that I talked about, but I got through about the first 7 months of the year and realized that I had enough to put a little book together. So this is the first half of the blog contained in this book. And so I already know that I'm going to do the same with the second. Now, this is not anything that will be published. It's a personal journal. Copies will go with my papers that are already in the special collections at the University of Nebraska libraries. But it's a way to make the material accessible, because who knows what will happen to the internet over time. But it's at any rate, I expect to continue my project, my journaling project through this year. And I'm about to launch one of the questions you said you were interested in discussing was the advent of digital textile design in my work. And that's where I'm soon going to be writing about that experience, which was, it was huge in terms of the capabilities and possibilities that it opened up in the visual dimensions of my work. And I'll always be grateful for that opportunity. That's one of the pluses as the university system, especially in a research one university. You have a mandate to do creative work, to conduct research, to do creative work, but you also get the support to do it. And having at my disposal cutting edge digital textile printer was huge in terms of the doors that opened for me and for the students that I worked with it. It was a huge advantage, I think, in their experience, in my experience as a teacher, but also in my experience as a maker.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Would you talk a little bit more about how that impacted your work? And as you said, it impacted students, it impacted other faculty within the department that now still are exhibiting digital textile printed quilts. And
Well, one of those was Vince Cavetto out at Kent State.
And yes, he's one of the guests on the podcast too.
He started working with the printer as well and has developed his work from that point quite successfully. Well, one of the limitations, or one of the challenges, let's say, of the conventional modes of quilt making is the difficulty of layering imagery, because processes are all so labor intensive and time intensive that there is, at least for me, there wasn't much immediacy. If I launched into a project, it was going to be at least a month to 2 or 3 months before completion. And a big piece of that was the having to work with commercial fabrics or trade fabrics, which was limiting. Now, I did get into surface design in the late 90s and was painting on fabric for a period of time. But again, it is still hugely labor intensive. Now, that said, digital textile printing, I found, is also time consuming and labor intensive. But the capability of getting imagery on fabric quickly is much higher. And that was great, because I learned very soon after that digital textile printer came into our department, I forced myself to learn the Adobe Creative Suite programs, especially Photoshop and Illustrator. And that was a steep uphill, because I wasn't particularly interested in that kind of technology initially or adept at it. But I forced myself, because I knew that would be the key to really taking advantage of the capabilities of the printer. And once I was able to really figure it out and learn how to apply it with the help of a fabulous studio assistant, Leah Sorensen Hayes, I was able to start producing fabric in the kinds of quantities that I would need to do bodies of work. And it was just, it was a great turn for me in terms of the kinds of visual images I was able to realize and the range of color I was able to integrate into my work and imagery as well. A lot of it was photographic in one form or another. Most of what goes into software programs like Photoshop and Illustrator is photographic, in at least in its origins. But also in the last 15 years, I started doing a lot of drawing direct into tablets using various hardware. So now I still design in my iPad, and it's phenomenal, really, the range of imagery that you have at the point of your stylus, using programs like Adobe Fresco and Photoshop for iPad and so on. It's quite stunning. And there are other programs too, and they're lots of fun. So that was a terrific opportunity.
Oh, I love that. And you're at a point in your career where you could have said, I don't want to learn any new technology. Why do I need to do this?
I caught on pretty quickly that if you didn't really learn to use and apply technology, you'd be left in other people's dust. And it worked out great for me, not just the design technology that I was using, but also all of the standard word processing technologies and online teaching technologies that really changed the thrust of my experience as a professor within 7 years of starting at the university. I was teaching strictly online. And from 2007 to when I retired 13 years later, all of my teaching was pretty much, there were a couple of exceptions, but pretty much all of my teaching was done online using, initially it was Blackboard that we used as the sort of platform. And then they switched closer to the end of my career. So actually, it was UNL's loss in a way that I retired just when I did. My last official day was January 31st, 2020. And 6 weeks later, the university had to go entirely online. And not all the faculty in my department, certainly not all the faculty across the university, had any online teaching experience or sufficient online teaching experience to completely move everything into that environment. So it was challenging for a lot of people, but it is education today. There is no way that we'll ever go back to older models, but it's also a hybrid thing, and you have to pull in lots of different ways of delivering information. And in a way, with my studio work, it became more of a hybrid thing once I was using technology to the degree. And I think the results that I got were far more varied than I would have been able to get without that digital technology.
Well, that makes sense. And I love what you say about teaching wise, because sometimes the thought is that design can't be taught online, but it gives such accessibility to more people to be able to, because not everyone can come to the college campus or to a workshop in person. And so to be able to deliver content.
Some things is a little more challenging, but there's a solution for everyone. And so it's a mode that I think now I'm talking about university students. It's a different age is important, and it's a different thing with elementary school students and junior high school and high school. That's a whole different ballgame. And certainly there are advantages to being face-to-face with someone in a physical setting. We're sentient beings, and we feel through the airwaves when we're in a room with people in ways different than in this kind of interchange. But all of it working together expands the possibilities and the potentials for experience and for enriching educational experiences and securing the outcomes and outputs that you're searching for when you're any kind of teacher and that you want when you're any kind of student. But it's definitely a different age that we're in now. And I can't imagine what it'll be like in 50 years. I won't be around to see it. That's the nature of it.
Right.
I read a lot of history because I'm fascinated with history, and also because I strongly believe that that adage that if you don't know the past and the failures and successes of the past, you'd be doomed to repeat the failures, or you'd miss potentials that led to the successors. I often think when I'm reading about somebody in the 18th century, how much more sophisticated their situation was than I ever imagined. Reading a very thorough and absorbing history of the cotton industry right now called Empire of Cotton by Sven Beckerts. And it is absolutely terrific. And I had really I didn't have a strong understanding of how widespread the cotton industry became thousands of years ago. It was what led to the huge expansion of trade across the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries. It was, people may not have had central heating or air conditioning, but they had very sophisticated systems, monetary systems, economic systems that I think it's important to understand that there is this huge, centuries of stories that bring us to where we are now. It's our tendency is to just be in the moment and think about the moment, but everything that we are is built from this long historical past.
And you bring up systems too, and I feel as a designer and artist, systems are an important part of the practice, but you've also, your time in academia, I feel can be a really good model for some of our audience who are academics about how to balance the systems of being a faculty member and an artist and a designer. You're having to integrate that professional practice of teaching, producing. You're an administrator. How did you balance all of that without?
It's funny that for this blog that I'm doing on my website, I use a program called Day One Journal, and it's a subscription program. And I've used it for travel journaling and just for lots of different sort of subject areas. And I am using it, and that's how I got the book, because it allows you to print out your journal. Well, I had this idea a week or so ago, and I just started an entry that I haven't expanded on because I'm not right there yet. It will come, but I knew I was going to address how I transitioned from the world of the independent freelance studio artist maker to academia. And I wrote one line. The person who said, those who can do, those who can't teach, has no clue. Because few things that I've ever done were as daunting and overwhelming as that segue into the academic sphere. Because it's enormously demanding. And you're charged as a faculty member at a university with teaching, with administration or participation in the workings and management and functionings of an academic department. And at a Research One university, like the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, you also have a requirement and a responsibility to conduct research and, in my case, do creative work that had outcomes that were demonstrable. And so to try to do all of that and maintain some semblance of a personal life, it's hugely challenging. People have no clue. And the idea that, well, at least I never saw it around me, this notion that a faculty member goes on campus and teaches one or two classes every few days, and then sits around in a coffee shop with their feet up on a stool. That is so not even close to reality. And I had never met a faculty member in my 20 years at UNL who wasn't extremely hardworking, extremely dedicated, committed to their students, committed to their responsibilities as multivalent, you know, faculty members. So I have enormous respect for that. And anybody who wants to say, if you can't teach, I'll say, you come and try it, you know? But you get a lot out of it as well. And the not least the support that the institution offers. At least I felt that. And as I looked around me, I saw a lot of faculty getting all kinds of supports in different ways. Certainly, they often had to go fight for it or seek it. But part of the plus of being at this university was all of the opportunities that it offered in terms of equipment and grant funding and travel support and all kinds of things that enriched every piece of your experience in the classroom, your experience with graduate students, your experience in your research or, in my case, creative work.
Yeah.
So the university has been called the new Medici, the Medici of the 20th, 21st century. And in some ways, it is that. Universities are also stressed, and always state universities particularly face financial pressures that are really, you know, imposing. But those who do it right also provide their faculty with scaffolding that allows them to produce and to advance the particular area of inquiry. And the whole point is to move ahead and to find new knowledge or to arrive at new, in the case of the arts, new perceptions, new interpretations of human experience, and representations of human experience. And I've always, I was an artist from when I was a little kid. My thinking, my way of looking at the world was from that perspective. So where I said earlier that books and reading were like food to me, so is art. And I could no more not have art, and I'll even expand it to artifacts, material culture. All of that is, it's our past, but it's also our present and future. And it's not just enrichment, but for me, it's always been a kind of fuel that helped me sustain everything I did when I wasn't, you know, sleeping. And probably sometimes when I was sleeping too.
Well, what's some advice that you would give to artists, designers, and academics as they are trying to push the boundaries, but also advance their careers?
I think it's easy to allow yourself to be discouraged. And sometimes it's a voice in your head that's discouraging you, and sometimes it's other people's indifference or lack of interest that discourages you. And I think first and foremost, you have to believe in what you're doing. And that's the biggest motivator, the biggest reason for doing it. And of course, you hit walls every once in a while where you start to doubt. And you just have to be persistent. You've chosen a path, whatever that path is. And sometimes there'll be obstacles, and you have to find a way around them, over them, under them, you know, through them. But I think it's a level of dedication that you bring to something that you love doing. And that, I think, that helps to secure your success in a way. And yeah, you do need other people to support you. You do need other people to encourage you or to set an example that you are motivated by, that you want to model what you do on. I think it's that. It's dedication and persistence. And another piece I think that is important, at least to me, is integrity. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, aside from believe in yourself, and that's a piece of what integrity is about, it's also hewing to your personal value system and being honest and truthful in your dealings with other people, in your particular practice. And, you know, that gets you to a point, I think, of genuineness, I guess, that it gives you a certain authority. And it's, you know, in an artist's case, it's maybe artistic authority, but there's also a dimension of moral authority. That is, integrity probably to me is the most important element in building a life in whatever field. And so, yeah. That's
very interesting you say that, because Innovation Insights is built on 6 values, and one of the values is integrity. So yeah. Thank you for your words on that. I completely agree with you. As we wrap this up, and
I was going to say, unfortunately, we live in a time where we're getting a lot of examples of people who have no integrity and have nothing to live by. And let it be a lesson. Let it be a parable.
I
interrupted you and started.
No. You were, that's wow. Well, we're going to have you back on because there's so much more to delve into. But one question that we ask all of our guests is, how do you define innovation?
Well, it's interesting. I thought about this because you said you were going to ask me this question. And innovation, I've always felt, for me, it's a step-by-step thing. It doesn't happen from one day to the next. Innovation is having a vision, first of all, and then working to develop the means to realize whatever that vision is. And then one thing I always found in the studio was that I'd be working on a series, or I'd be in a certain place in my work, and these objects that I was making, these textile constructions that I was making, were exactly what I could do at that moment. They were exactly what I had the capability to do at that moment. In my mind's eye, I could often see 5 years ahead of me a kind of fuzzy or something that I wanted my work to be like or to become. But I didn't have all the knowledge I needed, all the skills I needed, all the experience I needed at the present moment. But I still could visualize vaguely in my mind's eye what I would like to get to. And I saw this happen over and over across the course of my career. As time passed and I accumulated experience and knowledge and skills, I was able to realize the something that I had envisioned 5 years before or 10 years before. And so I think there's a saying that I like, I've lived by this too, and it has something to do with innovation. This was a Haida Indian carver named Robert Davidson. And he said, the only way to carry on tradition is to keep inventing new things. And that's really, it says you've got this foundation, whatever that tradition you come out of, whatever the tradition of your field has provided as a foundation, and you've built on that. And at some point, if you're persistent, if you're disciplined, if you're smart, if you've got all your senses open, you'll make a breakthrough. And that's the innovation. Now, an interesting side to this is that when I became department chair, and you know this from your own experience, when somebody becomes department chair, it's like somebody assumes a new, becomes the senator from the state of Nebraska or Iowa, or the new president elect. They start coming up with ideas. I want to do this, or let's do this. And you get a faculty group around you at a weekly or monthly faculty meeting. And as I did, they say, well, I'm thinking, how do you feel about X? We try this to help boost enrollment. And you've got always two or three who will say, and I had two in particular who almost unfailingly said, oh, no, we tried that years ago. No, we did that already. No, doesn't work. We tried that years ago. And that's an innovation squasher right there. But I would persist if I thought that there was some hope that this might work in new circumstances, with new participants, with new technologies, with new tools at our disposal, and also maybe with a somewhat revised attitude. And we did have successes in some things where we built on something that had been done years before but hadn't worked out. Well, when you have a different team, you've got different players, they're going to perform differently, and the end result is likely to be different. So I think that's what I have to say about innovation. And I don't know if it quite answers your question, but.
Oh, it does. It does. It was wonderful. And I love how you articulated, you know, the process that an innovator goes through and that vision, but maybe not being able to actualize it at that point in their life, in that time and space. And so I feel that will be so inspirational to our guest.
Well, I hope so. A lot of it is, it's often ambiguous. It's often, you're taking in inputs from all kinds of things. You're not sure how they're going to mix together, what kind of dish is going to come out of that oven. You've got to put it in the oven and see what happens, you know? And, you know, if it's not 100%, then keep going till it is, you know? No.
Oh.
I think I sound maybe a little more optimistic than I am by nature, because I have struggled all my life with being the glass half full person. And it took some real discipline for me, especially once I became a faculty member, to try to approach each day, each new class, each challenge as a glass half full rather than half empty kind of thing. And I succeeded to various degrees. Sometimes I didn't at all, but life is unpredictable. And it's challenging. And I think if you bring purpose and intent to how you approach those challenges, how you face and interact with those challenges, I think you tend to come out on the better end of the experience. So I guess I should try to sound optimistic most of the time.
Well, you've been very optimistic and inspirational to me personally through my life. And I just so appreciate you being here with us today and sharing your stories and your insights. This conversation really has been inspiring. And
thank you for
also, again, writing your blog, and for our audience and our viewers, please make sure you check out Michael's blog. We'll make sure that it's linked in the episode, and right. I will have you back, because we have many more topics that we haven't even touched on that I want to talk about with Great. You.
Okay, I'll look forward to
it. Well, thank you. Please stay tuned, everyone, for more inspiring stories on the Innovation Insights podcast, and be sure to follow us on our social media platforms. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on YouTube. And as always, keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.